Step six in the 10 steps to success is called taking action, or act to create it. You got to take action. You can't just visualize and affirm, but when you get creative impulses and creative ideas, you have to act on them. If you look at the word satisfaction, which everyone says they want more satisfaction in their life, if you look at the roots of that word, it comes from two words in Latin, satis, S-A-T-I-S, which means enough, and facere, F-A-C-E-R-E, which means to make. Enough making produces satisfaction. Notice it's not too much making, the workaholic, but it's enough. So you've got to take action if you want satisfaction. And the last six letters in that word spell what? Action. So action's key. I want you to repeat this after me. The universe rewards action. Would you all say that?
The universe rewards action.
That's right. Have you ever known people with really good ideas, really bright, six PhDs, couldn't fight their way out of a paper bag in terms of making their life work? And have you ever known someone that never graduated from high school, isn't that smart, maybe they can't spell really well, and they own all the real estate on the west side of town?
Yep.
You know? So you got to get out there and do something with it. One of the techniques that I mentioned earlier was what we call acting as if. If you want to have a certain job or you want to be a certain way in life, start acting as if right now. I remember a friend of mine wanted to be an actress, and she went to a workshop, and the people in the workshop told her, look, from now on, you're an actress. Someone says, what do you do for a living? You say, I'm an actress. If they say, how long? Well, it's been about an hour and a half so far. Okay? So you declare and you act as if. Then you dress like, act like, talk like, interact like, read the magazines that an actress reads. And you say the things that you think you'd be saying and doing if you're already there. One of the techniques that W. Clement Stone taught me when I was working for him, again, multimillionaire, self-made person, started with $10,000 investment and built up an insurance and publishing empire. He said, always carry a $100 bill in your pocket. Because every time you go in to get some money and spend it, you'll always see the $100. And what does that tell you? Hey, I'm rich. That was like 25 years ago. Today, maybe it has to be $300 bills to feel like you're rich. But the idea is that you carry it around and you act as if you're already there. Another technique for creating it the way you want it is a little phrase I first learned from somebody in San Diego. She looked me right in the eye one day when I was scared, and she said, so what? Do it anyway. So what? Do it anyway. I'd like to share a little mantra with you. I want you to take your hands and join your two fingers together, your thumb and your forefinger. Put them out to your side like this, if you would. And I want you to repeat after me in the same tone. This is what you do anytime you get scared and you're afraid to take action. You just repeat this to yourself. Oh, what the heck? Everybody? Oh, what the heck? Go for it anyway. Go for it anyway. One more time. Oh, what the heck? Go for it anyway. Very good. How many of you can dive off a diving board into a swimming pool? Can I see a show of hands? About half the people in the room. Can you remember being on the edge of the board looking down at the water when you were maybe 5 or 6 years old and the water was 7 feet deep and there was 3 feet between you and the board and you were another 4 feet tall? It's a lot of space to jump into. And if you were like me, you were standing there and you were scared to death. You're going, oh, I can't possibly jump. Now, how many of you looked down at your mom or dad or the swimming coach and said, look, I'm not jumping. You're taking me to a therapist. We're going to work on this fear of jumping into water. When I have that handled, then I'll come back and jump. Did any of you do that? No. You did what? You felt the fear and you jumped anyway. I had this friend who took the workshop. She's become a friend since she took one of my workshops. She works on the board of directors of a school for emotionally disturbed children. She's actually a businesswoman, but she also serves on this board. And after the seminar, she was in a bank and she was dressed in like a t-shirt and blue jeans. And she was thinking, you know, here's this bank. They got a lot of money. We need money for the school that I'm on the board of. I think I'll ask the president for some money. So she starts to walk up the stairs, and then all of a sudden, a little voice in her head says, you can't go up now. You're dressed in a t-shirt. You're dressed in blue jeans. They're never going to give you any money. The funding cycle's probably already over. There's no way. And then she hears this little voice that went, oh, what the heck? Go for it anyway. And she said, okay, what can I lose? So she goes up. She talks to the secretary. They let her in. She talks to the president. He says, look, we've given away all our money for this quarter. You know, we do it by the board and everything. But call me in a week and we'll see what happens. Now, she had asked him for $10,000. Called him in a week. He said, look, I can't give you $10,000, but I'll give you $2,000. See, $2,000 she never would have had if she hadn't just gone for it anyway. Some people say, I can't ask, Jack. I'm too young. Some people say, I can't ask, I'm too old. Well, let's get rid of that. Too young. 9-year-old girl, Marquita Andrews, wants to take her mother around the world. Doesn't know how she can do that. She's a poor little kid in New York. All of a sudden, the Girl Scouts come out with a contest. Say, whoever sells the most Girl Scout cookies in the whole country gets to win a trip around the world for two. Marquita says, here's my ticket. Marquita Andrews, in her first year, sold 3,528 boxes of Girl Scout cookies. You know how she did it? She asked people to buy one by one. She'd knock on a door. Now, here's how I used to ask when I was a kid selling seeds for the Boy Scouts. Hi, I'm selling seeds for the Boy Scouts. You don't want to buy any seeds, do you? Nope, sure don't want to do that. Well, thank you. Didn't think so. Here's Marquita. Hi, my name's Marquita Andrews, and I have a dream. I want to take my mom around the world by selling more Girl Scout cookies than anyone in the country. How many boxes will you buy to support me in my dream? People go, 10, 20, whatever. The little kid was clear. She asked. And she asked by sharing her vision. So you've got to be willing to ask. If you ask, you'll increase your odds of getting it by 200%. Step number 7, respond to feedback. After you take action, what you have to do is respond to feedback. What is the feedback from your universe? See, if I take action, it might be the wrong action. I need to be willing and open to get feedback. Now, there's two kinds of feedbacks. One is called internal feedback. It's called what you feel in your body. You feel depressed, you feel alive, you feel healthy, you feel loving, you feel joyful. And the other is called external feedback. It's called feedback you get from the universe. They fire you, they hire you, they give you a promotion, they invite you to a party, they don't invite you to a party, they say they never want to see you again, your wife leaves you. That's all external feedback. Now, there's two kinds of external and internal feedback, positive and negative. Which kind do you like best?
Positive.
Positive. However, have you ever gotten value from negative feedback?
Yeah.
Yes. Have you ever had someone tell you something that it was hard to hear, but it was really valuable?
Yes. Yep.
Okay. So in order to be successful in life, you have to be willing to respond to the feedback. You have to ask for feedback. You have to look for feedback, invite feedback, welcome feedback. So you're going to make mistakes when you take action. Let the universe give you feedback and then fix it. Every time you make a mistake, what happens? You learn something. And you've got to be willing to take in that learning. When I started self-esteem seminars, I made more mistakes than you can ever believe. One time I sent a bulk mailing to the bulk mailing place, and I had printed the stamp, the little indicia that says, you know, bulk mail. I printed it on the wrong side of the envelope, so it was on the wrong side of the brochure, so that when it would go into the automatic stamping machine at the post office, it would eat these things, it would destroy them. In other words, you need the folded end to go in first. I had it the opposite. I lost $2,000 and had to start all over. Right? Do you think I ever made that mistake again?
No.
Right. But you have to be willing to get in the game and make mistakes. We all know the famous story of Thomas Edison who tried 9,000 or 10,000 filaments to make the light bulb. People would say, Dr. Edison or Mr. Edison, boy, you really screwed up. He says, son, I never screwed up once. He said, I invented the light bulb. Happened to be a 9,000-step process. See? So each mistake is going to get you closer to the goal. So don't get upset about it. Be willing to get involved. Some of the famous failures that you may have heard of, I don't know if you know this, but Fred Astaire, when he did his first screen test, the memo that was sent to the people at the top of the organization read like this. Can't act, slightly bald, can dance a little. And Astaire eventually got a hold of that memo and framed it and put it above his fireplace. The next step is step 8. It says perseverance. Perseverance. Simply stated, keep on keeping on. See, you take action, you get feedback, and you correct. When you get the feedback, you don't get defensive, you don't make people wrong for it. You say, fine, I'll do it. And you keep correcting, and you keep persevering until you get your goal. One of the favorite phrases that I have that we use in our company is called no matter what. I'm going to get my goal no matter what. See, when I set a goal and I commit to it, and it's a scary goal, the first thing that comes up inside of me is what I call roadblocks, fears, and considerations. I can't do that. I'll have to borrow money. I've never borrowed money before. I don't want to risk my house. I don't know the technology for that. I don't know anyone who's ever done that before. People will think I'm foolish. People will think I'm too greedy. I'll have to expand my staff. I don't want to move into a bigger office space. You know, all that stuff comes up. And it's called, so what? Do it anyway. It's called, I'm going to achieve my goal no matter what. But you've got to find a way to support yourself to deal with the resistances that will show up in your life when you commit, because they will be there. And you've got to persevere. There was a woman that I hired recently to do this video for welfare people that I've talked about. Her name was Torsi Wiley, a black woman from Mississippi, and tried to convince her to write a book called From Mississippi to Malibu, because she lives in Malibu now. She's a real estate developer. She grew up as a sharecropper's daughter in Mississippi. And what she noticed one day as she went into town for her parents was there were people actually making a living sitting in a building instead of out in a field picking cotton. And she said, wow, that's for me. And she said, I want to do that. She says, wow, they're sitting there, they got their legs crossed, they got air conditioning, they pick up the phone. This is the kind of job I want to have. So she saved a little money and she went to night school. And she studied typing. Now, she had no typewriter. She literally took a cereal box, turned it inside out, drew all the keys of the typewriter on it, and every night practiced typing on that cereal box with her fingers for an hour. She had perseverance, she had dedication, she had commitment, she had will. And she said there were a lot of times she wanted to give up because they weren't supporting her. She was black, she was in the South. She wasn't getting what she wanted, but she went for it anyway. And last time I talked to Torsi, she was worth several million dollars worth of real estate in the California area because she persevered and she went for it. She didn't let people beat her down. Jonathan Livingston Seagull, the great story when Richard Bach was trying to sell Jonathan Livingston Seagull, 51 publishers turned him down. Wouldn't have you hated to be one of those publishers? Other than the Bible and a few cookbooks, it's a book that sold more copies than almost any book in the country. Aristotle Onassis, one of the richest men that ever lived, didn't start out that way. His father died in prison in Greece. I think it was debtor's prison. And what happens was, Onassis is in South America, and he tried to get an appointment with this guy to do a deal with him, to try to get something rolling, because at that time he was working in the phone company as an operator. And he had this idea for import-export, the way he could make some money. Couldn't get an appointment. Finally decided to stand on the guy's doorstep until he could get an appointment. He was there for 21 days. Never left. 21 days. Guy would come to work and he'd say, finally, on the 21st day, he says, hey, what are you doing here? You're always on my doorstep. And he's got bodyguards around him. He's this really rich businessman. He says, I'm trying to get an appointment with you. He says, well, what's so damn important? He says, well, if you'll walk me to your car, I'll tell you. Between the time they left the building and walked to the car, which was only about 100 feet, he sold him on the deal. And since then, you know, he became one of the richest men that ever lived. Gunther Kleinfeld, who wanted to get a deal with Onassis, had read about Onassis, rented an apartment in the same building as Onassis in New York and rode up and down on the elevator every day, all day long, for 7 days. Because he knew eventually Onassis was going to have to come either in or out. And he sold him a deal from the top floor down to the bottom floor that made him several million dollars. But it's called perseverance, not giving up. I don't know if you know this, but the average millionaire in America has gone bankrupt 3.5 times. I don't know how you go bankrupt half a time. But I'm well on my way to being a millionaire, I guess, because I've gone bankrupt twice, so I'm getting close. But seriously, they go bankrupt 3.5 times, which means they go big, and they lose, and they start over. Walt Disney, the stories vary, but went bankrupt between 5 and 7 times before he built Disneyland. And then when he went to build Epcot Center, they said, forget it. He said, I need, you know, several $1 billion. And they said, no way. What do we have down in Florida? We have the Epcot Center. What's opening up in Russia? Disneyland. What's opened up already in Tokyo? What do they talk about building in China? In Japan? You know, because that man had a dream and a vision and he wouldn't take no for an answer. See, how committed are you in the face of no agreement? Are you willing to keep going no matter what and persevere and go to the end and get what you want? Because if you are, you'll get your goal. And if you're not, you won't. One of the questions that often comes up in this whole area of going for your goal, living your dream, living your highest vision is, what do you do when you don't get it? You set a goal to have a certain thing by a certain time, you don't get it. There's a concept which we call high intention, low attachment, which is really critical at this point, to realize two things, that I'm going to go for my goal with the highest intention possible. I'm going to commit to it. I'm going to do whatever it takes, no matter what. And yet sometimes, no matter what you do, you still don't get it. And so then what you have to do is realize that it's okay. Not beat yourself up for not getting your goal. That's not going to build your self-esteem and not going to make you feel good about going for goals. So at that point, what you need to do is recommit to the goal or reassess. Is this goal really a valid goal for me at this time in my life? Maybe I started pursuing this, it was important to me, and now I realize my children are more important than perhaps owning the biggest house on Lake Michigan. So let's look at the 9th step together. After taking action and correcting from feedback and then persevering, the next thing that shows up is the best one. It's called Reap the Rewards. Step 9, Reap the Rewards. You get the result. Now, it may take longer than you want, and it may show up instantly, but you will get there if you keep on. I've got some goals I've been working on 30 years. They're not here yet, but I'm really, really close to some of them. It's really exciting. I have other goals I set, and I think it'll take me 2 years, and a week later, it shows up in my life. So eventually, you'll get the reward. Now, a couple techniques I want to share with you about rewarding yourself when you get the reward, when you get the goal. One is called a joyful and triumphant fund. And what you do is every time you have a positive experience in your life, you get a goal, you take a $100 bill and you write down what the goal was that you achieved and you put it in your pocket and you carry it around with you. And then I predetermine a amount that when I get to, when I've got so many of these $100 bills, like let's say $2,000, that I will spend it on myself doing something totally frivolous and self-pleasuring. Like I'll take tennis lessons, or I'll rent a limousine for 3 days and drive all over Los Angeles, or I'll go to Tahiti. I can't do it for someone else. I can't put it in my grandchildren's expense account for school, even if I think that would make me feel good. It has to be for me. Now, the neat thing about this, when I start having wins, and then I start to get to even have a bigger win because of the win, what does my unconscious want to create more of?
Wins.
Wins. See, I start having more joyful and triumphant experiences. Another one is called the 5% opulence account. It means that all the income that you take in, you take 5% of it and you put it in what we call your opulence account. And much like the joyful and triumphant fund, it must be spent on something that you would normally only spend it on if you were very wealthy, like buying a certain kind of clothing that normally you wouldn't afford, or again, the limousine, or a vacation, or a week worth of body massages, whatever it is. So you start giving yourself the experiences of success. Because I know a lot of people that win, that make money, and then they deny themselves. You know, I know a person's a multimillionaire and always wanted a Mercedes because they grew up in Germany and won't let themselves buy one because they think somehow they shouldn't do that. So start allowing yourself to appreciate your successes. There's a feeling that comes when you achieve something. We talk about savoring our successes and the sweet taste of victory. People are so fast today in their lifestyle that we get to a place where we should really celebrate, and there's almost like not even time for it. We just get on to the next thing. One of the things that often happens, and I think it grows out of our childhood, is that people took it for granted that they expected us to do well. You know, you were expected to get A's in school. You were expected to keep your room clean. You were expected to talk respectfully to your parents. And so whenever you did something that was good, very often people never said, hey, way to go, good job. They didn't celebrate the success. They just expected you to do it. It was no big deal. What happens is if you take all of your successes for granted and you don't celebrate them, you don't reward yourself, then you're not reinforcing yourself for all that effort. And we really need to celebrate ourselves. And if people don't do it for us, then we need to create it for ourselves. And we even need to do that with our little accomplishments, our small accomplishments. I'll even give myself a reward for going to the gym 3 times in a week. I'll say, if I go to the gym 3 times this week, I'm going to rent that video I've always wanted to watch, or I'm going to really compliment myself extra when I do the mirror exercise tonight. One of the things I recommend people do to build up their self-esteem is to create a nurture myself list. And what that means is a list of ways you can nurture yourself. Things for me are going to a bookstore, just browsing in a bookstore. I love to do that. Another one for me is walking on the beach or taking a walk in the woods or listening to classical music. Another thing I love to do is listen to comedy albums. You know, so I make this list called my nurturing list, and I have one on my refrigerator and I have one in my bathroom. And anytime I'm starting to feel depressed or I'm feeling like I need something, I just refer to my list. I think, oh, I haven't done that in a long time. That's a way I could nurture myself. Because usually when I start to feel lonely or I start to feel undeserving or I start to feel down, that's the least likely time I'm going to feel creative. It's like I need a friend to say, hey, come on, snap out of it. So my nurturing list is a way to snap myself out of it and remind me of things I can do that'll make me feel good. And we deserve to feel good. And so as I nurture myself more, it builds up that sense that I deserve to feel nurtured. The last step is called the attitude of gratitude. It's giving thanks to other people. Thank all the people that supported you on the way to the top. Now, some people tithe 10% of their income to their church or to service organizations or to people that have assisted them. Other people write letters thanking people. I was teaching this stuff for years, and I was still not a very good acknowledger, a thanker. And once I remember I achieved a goal, and five or six people had really helped me. And about 3 months later, my friend saw me, and he said, "Hey, did you ever get that goal?" And I said, "Yeah, I got it." He said, "Well, why didn't you let us know? We helped you, and you never told us." I thought, my God, I do that. So I literally now, a half hour every Friday before I quit for the week, I sit down and I write thank you notes. I don't care if I haven't even got a lot of them to write. I make them up. You know, I thank my mother again. I thank my brother for being such a good brother. I thank my secretary for a great week. But usually I'm writing things off to people that have hired me, people that have supported me, people that have been there when I call them on the phone. So give thanks to people. One of the basic rules of success is as you prosper others, they will prosper you. And so I think if you want to be successful, you find ways to serve others, and then they will be willing to serve you back. It doesn't always come from the person that you give to. In other words, I may do something for my mother, but my mother doesn't necessarily do something back for me. But somewhere down the road, someone else will do something back for me. It's like there's this law in the universe, the law of balance. You can't give something away without getting something in return. And you may not get it in the timing you imagine you're going to get it. You may not get it in the way you think you're going to get it. But I've never had the experience of feeling like I gave something away and that I didn't get something back in return. At the very least, when I do something for someone else, I feel the love and the fulfillment from doing it. And there's that fulfillment that just comes from making a difference. Let me end this by telling you about a woman in Florida by the name of Laura Schultz. In 1977, when she was 63 in Tallahassee, Florida, her grandson was playing out in the driveway, and they were playing around her old Buick, and one of the kids got in a car and accidentally tripped the emergency brake, and the car kind of rolled back and lodged on her grandson's leg. She heard the screaming, and she came running out, and she tried to, you know, move the car at first, and eventually she got right behind the car, and she just lifted it up. Now, we're talking about a major car. Buicks are not small cars back then, right? And about a half hour later, some of the men in the neighborhood heard about this, and they came over, and they tried to lift this car. They couldn't do it. Now, a friend of mine named Charles Garfield, some of you may know his work on peak performance, he wanted to interview her because he thought, this is a pretty peak performing event here. I'd like to find out, you know, what's the secret? How did this little lady do that? Because it had been reported in the National Enquirer. That's where he read about it. And when they interviewed her, she said, "I have never in my life picked up more than a 50-pound bag of flour before. So here's this car, you know, a ton or more of steel." So Charlie called her up and said, "I'd like to interview you." And she said, "Well, you know, that's a great idea, but I don't give interviews." And she hung up. Called her back again, said, "I'd like to interview." She said, "I told you I don't give interviews." Hung up. So finally he was down in Florida for a conference once. He drives over to Tallahassee, finds her house, and he knocks on the door. He says, "Hi, my name's Dr. Charles Garfield, and I've been doing research on peak performers, and you're the lady who picked up that Buick. I'd like to talk to you about that event." She said, "Dr. Garfield, I told you on the phone, I don't give interviews. You know, why are you so darn persistent?" He says, "Well, I'm a peak performer, and that's one of the keys, perseverance." He said, "But I'd really like to talk to you." She said, "Well, where'd you come from?" He said, "Well, I've been over at this conference." He said, "Well, you drove all the way over. Come on in." And she said, "Have you had breakfast yet?" He said, "No." She said, "Well, let me cook you breakfast." So she starts cooking him breakfast. And he starts talking, and they're talking about the weather and grandchildren and all this stuff. And he keeps trying to steer her over to talk about the Buick. And every time he gets close, she steers away. And finally, he just confronted her directly. He said, "Laura, why is it that you're unwilling to talk about the Buick?" And she said, "You know, I don't like to talk about the event." She called it the event. She says, "Because when you're my age and you do something you didn't think you could do, it challenges all your beliefs about life." She says, "Because if I lifted that Buick and I didn't think that was possible, what else in my life might have I done that was possible that I didn't do?" Then she said, "The question that comes up for me is, did I waste my life?" And he said, "How old are you?" She said she was 60-some. And he said, "Well, what did you really want to do with your life?" She said, "Well, when I was a young girl, you know, our girls in our family didn't go to college. The boys went to college. I always wanted to go to college and study rocks, geology. So why don't you go? You got this house. You can mortgage it and second mortgage it. You know, go to school." She said, "Charlie, you don't understand. So I'll be over 65 years old by the time I get out of school." He says, "I got some bad news for you. 4 years from now, whether you go to school or not, you're still going to be 65, and you're not going to be studying geology." She said, "Well, you do got a point there." 2 years later, Charlie gets a letter. I just got my AA degree in geology. 2 years later, she gets her BA. She's now teaching geology at a community college in Florida. See, and the question I would ask you as you listen to this is, are you going to get to the old age stage of your life and say, gosh, I wish I had done that, when you could have changed your beliefs about what was possible simply by setting your goal, visualizing the result you want, affirming it, and that way changing your belief system about what was possible. But I tell you that story because I know when you go home tonight and you do that mirror exercise we talked about, you're going to see two eyes looking back at you from the mirror. And I want you to realize that behind those eyes, it's the little kid in you that maybe hasn't had their dream come true yet. And I hope you'll have the courage and the willingness and the wit and the support that you need to enhance your self-esteem, to accept your body, to love yourself, to express your emotions, to trust your mind and your intuition and start being more positive, and to set goals, to visualize and to affirm, because you deserve to have all of your dreams come true.
Taking on the task of building your self-esteem could be one of the most important journeys you'll ever embark on. It's a journey that has a reward at the end that's the most powerful thing you can ever have, and that's a really full experience and appreciation of yourself. Take the time by yourself, with others, to work on you, because you are the most precious gift you'll ever have, and you need to take good care of that gift. Because the whole crux of self-esteem is that you deserve to feel good about yourself. You deserve to celebrate yourself. You deserve to have everything you want in life. You deserve to be happy, to be healthy, to have relationships that work. So listen to these tapes a number of times. You know, really immerse yourself in this material. It's kind of like taking an auditory self-esteem bath. Keep reinforcing these ideas and re-inspiring yourself and re-motivating yourself. Thousands of people have used these techniques, and they work for them. And I know that because I've seen the results. But you've got to put these activities into practice. The reason I'm involved in self-esteem work is because I think it's the bottom line of every problem anyone ever has. When you feel you've got high self-esteem and you realize you can cope with anything, then what you do is you participate in life in a way that'll produce miracles. So as you begin this journey, if you choose to take it, I want you to know that perhaps the real seminar begins now, not from listening to this, but from utilizing that which you've learned. Good luck. For the final cassette in this album, we have refined an exercise that we've successfully used in our seminars to accelerate an even deeper integration of the material you have learned. This powerful technique is called the Tri-Think Integration Process. Please take a moment and read the accompanying written material, which explains how to get the optimum value out of this tape.